DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Okay, so if you've ever, like, actually been down in the basement of the Comedy Cellar in Manhattan, that legendary place, low ceilings.
Oh, yeah.
You immediately get it. The real forces in New York comedy, they aren't always the huge names just dropping in.
Right. It's the regulars.
Exactly. It's the pillars, the ones who are there night after night owning that stage, the ones who can, you know, turn a tough room around.
Handle a cold audience, yeah. And maybe even more importantly, they're often the ones writing the really killer stuff for the big stars.
That specific environment, that kind of pressure cooker of live comedy, it demands, well, something more than just being funny, right?
It absolutely does. It takes years, decades even, of just showing up, consistency, and resilience. Plus, you need a really sharp point of view.
And today, we're diving deep into someone who really embodies all of that. An American stand-up comedian, actor, Keith Robinson.
Keith Robinson, yeah. A perfect example of that relentless dedication.
So our mission here, for you listening, is to really unpack his whole career. We're going to trace it all the way back.
From Philadelphia, his roots.
Yeah, his Philly origins, and get into what this back-of-the-bus funny thing really means. His style. Then look at his work behind the scenes, and yeah, we mean the writer's room for Chappelle's Show.
Crucial.
And, of course, in front of the camera, too. And it all kind of culminates in this, honestly, pretty remarkable return to comedy after a huge health crisis.
It's an incredible story of how comedy really became his lifeline.
Absolutely.
We've gone through quite a stack of sources here, biographical stuff, looking at his career milestones, the types of comedy he does, those personal challenges.
Yeah, we've synthesized a lot to really give you the full picture.
So by the end of this deep dive, you'll have a solid understanding of this guy who's like a really pivotal figure, almost
like an institutional asset. Maybe.
Yeah, like a cornerstone of the modern comedy scene. His influence, it cuts across generations, different media.
It really does.
And we have to start with that signature phrase you mentioned. Keith Robinson, he's known for saying back of the bus funny.
No, that's not just some random tagline, is it? It feels like it tells you something specific about his comedy before he even tells a joke. What does it signal?
Well, it's immediate, isn't it? It signals perspective.
Yeah.
Back of the bus funny. It instantly puts the humor in a certain, let's say, social and maybe economic context.
Okay.
It suggests a viewpoint that's maybe, you know, outside the mainstream, a bit skeptical of authority, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely not too worried about being politically correct all the time. It's humor that comes from, like, close observation.
Like people watching on the bus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those environments where people are often, you know, less guarded, more honest, maybe.
Right.
And he started cultivating that way back in his teens. So that core honesty, that's what lets him move between different kinds of comedy.
Like satire, observational stuff.
Yeah. And the really tricky ones, like black comedy, even cringe humor.
Cringe humor.
It's basically a promise that what you're going to get is authentic.
Yeah.
And it keeps people listening.
All right, let's dig into that history then. Starting right there in Philadelphia, where the sources say the wit really began. He was apparently working on this very specific back-of-the-bus funny style way back as a teenager, so it really wasn't just a brand he picked up later.
No, not at all. It sounds as if it's fundamental, an ethos, like you said earlier.
Right.
I mean, think about that environment. He wasn't like polishing jokes in some improv class.
Ah, probably not.
No, he was figuring out timing, sharpening his observations, just trying to get laughs in a social setting that could be, you know, pretty tough. Competitive, maybe.
Makes sense.
And that raw street-level wit, that's the foundation for his whole career. Which, by the way, has been going on for decades.
Right. You mentioned he started way back.
Yeah. Back in the 1980s, he was part of a comedy group called Comedy Express.
Wow. The 80s.
Yeah. So he'd already put in, like, over 10 years grinding it out on the regional circuits, really honing his act before he even got a sniff of national TV.
That's some serious groundwork.
It's crucial groundwork. It explains why he's stuck around, why he has that staying power.
So, okay, four decades, basically, building that material, that timing. When did that circuit experience finally hit the national stage?
Well, his first really big national moment came in 1993. This was kind of the start of the cable comedy boom.
Okay.
But he broke through using a very traditional platform, Ed McMahon's Star Search.
Oh, Star Search. Wow, that was the show back then, wasn't it? Like the ultimate talent show.
It was huge, super high stakes TV, comedians basically performing under this massive spotlight, judged by a mass audience.
Intense pressure.
Totally intense. And look, being a finalist on Star Search in the early 90s, that was serious validation.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the internet really changed how people got discovered.
Right, no YouTube clips going viral.
Exactly. So even though he didn't actually win the whole competition.
He was a finalist, you said.
Yeah, finalist. Just getting that far was a massive step. It was like the mainstream industry saying, okay, this guy's got it.
He's polished enough.
Right. He had the kind of appeal needed for network TV, even while his style was still very much, you know.
Back of the bus.
Back of the bus, funny.
Yeah. So that Star Search success suggested, okay, he's ready for bigger things. But his style, his genres, they show he was always comfortable playing in the, let's say, the darker, more complicated corners of comedy.
Oh, definitely.
Let's look at the genres you mentioned. Cringe humor, black comedy, satire, and observational comedy. That's a really interesting mix. Versatile, but maybe tricky.
It is tricky. And what's really fascinating is how he uses them, how he shifts between them. Each one is like a different tool for tackling sensitive stuff.
How so?
Well, observational comedy is kind of the starting point, right?
Yeah.
He sees something happening out in the world.
Okay.
Satire is often the weapon, using humor to critique whatever he's observing.
Right.
But then black comedy in cringe humor.
Yeah.
Those are more about the delivery, the tone.
Mm-hmm.
Black comedy lets him take really serious, dark topics, systemic problems, personal tragedy, whatever, and find the humor without, you know, being disrespectful.
That's a fine line to walk.
A very fine line.
And cringe humor. We hear that term thrown around a lot now, usually for awkward sitcoms or something. How does Robinson use it in stand-up, especially when he's talking about heavy topics like race or dating or political correctness?
Yeah, that's where the whole back-of-the-bus perspective is key again. The cringe part isn't always about Robinson himself being awkward.
Okay.
Often it comes from the audience's own discomfort. He's hitting a nerve, exposing some uncomfortable truth about society, or maybe even about us in the audience.
Ah, I see.
So when he gets into dating or race, the cringe is that feeling of confronting our own assumptions, maybe our hypocrisies. He makes you squirm a little.
Not because the joke bombed, but because it landed too well.
Exactly. Because it hit a little too close to home to some shared awkward reality we don't always talk about.
So he's definitely not avoiding controversy. He's using it.
Using it as fuel, absolutely.
And the sources say his material often comes straight from his life in Philly, like specific stories about just getting by, even run-ins with the police.
Yeah. And that's what locks in the authenticity. That's the observational part, grounding everything.
Right.
When a comedian uses real-life stuff, dealing with authority, complex social issues, especially from a perspective that isn't, you know, privileged, the comedy just has more weight. It makes the social commentary feel real. It makes you, the listener, trust that you're getting raw truth just filtered through his wit.
And it earns him the right to push boundaries, like with political correctness.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it feels earned. It's rooted in actual lived experience, not just abstract ideas.
That grounding, that authenticity, it seems like that's what made him so essential to the live comedy scene, especially in New York.
Definitely.
He wasn't just passing through Manhattan. The sources paint him as like a permanent fixture centered at probably the most respected club in the world, right? The Comedy Cellar.
So, yeah, it's more than just a club. It's like the ultimate proving ground for stand-up.
Why is it so legendary?
Well, the room itself, that low ceiling, the audience is literally right on top of the stage.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. It looks intense.
It amplifies everything. Every laugh, every silence. It's famously one of the toughest rooms anywhere.
Yeah.
But Robinson's role there, it's even more telling. He's often the MC.
The MC. Why is that specific job, especially at the Cellar, such a big deal? More than just doing a regular set.
Because the MC has maybe the hardest job in comedy, period.
Really?
Yeah. They control the whole night's energy. They have to talk directly to the crowd, often when the crowd is still settling in, maybe hasn't even ordered drinks yet.
Warming them up,
dealing with hecklers sometimes, and crucially, bridging the gaps between totally different styles of comedians. It takes incredible improv skills, crowd control.
Diplomatic skills, almost.
Totally. You have to read the room instantly, adjust the mood on a dime. If the MC bombs, the whole show could just fall apart.
Wow.
So for Robinson to be a frequent MC there, that means the club trusts him completely. He's the reliable guy, the anchor holding the night together.
That's serious industry respect.
Huge respect. And it got officially recognized back in 2012. Time Out New York actually named him one of the 21 New York comedy scene linchpins.
Linchpins. That's a great word for it.
It fits perfectly.
Yeah.
He wasn't just performing there. He was like part of the essential infrastructure of the New York comedy scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of credibility, being such a constant presence on the live scene, that really laid the groundwork for his TV and film stuff, often led to working with some really big names.
Right. Let's get into those major TV collaborations.
Looking at his career, he often popped up in these really visible supporting roles. Roles where he could still be himself, comedically, but reach a huge audience.
Mm-hmm. One of the first big ones was being the announcer and sidekick on the Wanda Sykes Show.
Okay, Wanda Sykes.
Big name.
Huge. And that role, being a sidekick, it's a different discipline. You know, you go from total freedom in your stand-up to the structured rhythm of a TV show. You need to provide consistent banter, support the host, support Wanda Sykes. It's about teamwork, not just your own jokes.
Adapting his style. But the sources really emphasize the exposure he got from being a regular on Comedy Central's Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. Now that show, that was known for being pretty brutal, right?
Well, Tough Crowd was a furnace. Seriously. It was a unique format, basically just comedians sitting around riffing, arguing about current events, trying to land the killer lines.
Ooh, it's intense.
It demanded super quick, sharp, almost intellectual humor, sometimes pretty adversarial, too.
Yeah, I remember that vibe.
Being a regular there.
Uh-huh.
That cemented his reputation, not just as, like, a funny guy, but as someone who could really think on his feet, a critical thinker who could handle political, social commentary instantly.
Skills beyond just telling jokes.
Way beyond. It was a perfect showcase for the intelligence behind that back of the bus funny thing.
And that connection with Colin Quinn, it wasn't a one-off, right? He was also on Quinn's short-lived NBC show.
Yeah, the Colin Quinn show. He kept working with him. And beyond Quinn, I mean, his name pops up everywhere in that era. Chelsea Lately on E.
Oh, yeah, that roundtable.
The Opie and Anthony radio show, which was, you know, pretty wild.
Infamous, some might say.
Huh, maybe. Plus, appearances on MTV, VH1, and crucially, HBO's Def Comedy Jam.
Def Comedy Jam was foundational, especially for black comedians.
Absolutely launched countless careers. Being on that show was huge.
So all these different appearances, what does that tell us?
It just highlights how adaptable he was. By the mid-2000s, people in the industry knew Robinson could deliver. He could bring sharp material to basically any format.
Whether it was raw radio or a structured sitcom like Are We There Yet, which he was also in.
Exactly. Or even sitting on the couch for late night with Conan O'Brien. Highly respected spot.
He proved he could adjust, you know, the volume, the topic, but still be authentically Keith Robinson.
That's the key. Without losing that core self.
Okay, shifting over to movies. His film credits also show some range. Yeah, he was funny in big comedies like Trainwreck.
Right, with Amy Schumer.
But he also did roles in, like, serious dramas.
Hey.
Biopics. Stuff like Rebound, The Legend of Earl the Goat Manigault.
Mm-hmm. And Diary of a Tired Black Man, which dealt with some complex themes.
That's interesting. It shows he wasn't just seen as the comedian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It suggests that the kind of weight needed for black comedy.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying D.C. politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
And satire. That can translate into real acting ability. He wasn't just pigeonholed as the guy who delivers punchlines.
He could handle drama.
He could hold down roles with emotional depth.
Uh-huh.
And we should also mention, he appeared in that massive Kevin Hart stand-up film, Laugh at My Pain.
Right, Kevin Hart.
Which kind of officially puts him in the same circle as arguably the biggest comedian on the planet commercially.
And that Kevin Hart connection, that seems really important, especially leading up to a big moment in his own stand-up career. He'd done a half-hour special for Comedy Central before, right?
Yeah, earlier on.
But in 2014, he releases his first full one-hour special, his defining special up to that point.
And the title tells you a lot. Kevin Hart presents Keith Robinson. Back of the bus funny.
Kevin Hart presents. That's huge.
It's absolutely immense. Kevin Hart is a global brand. When he puts his name on something like that, lending his platform to a fellow comedian,
it's more than just a favor.
Oh, way more. It's a massive signal to the industry, to Hart's enormous audience, saying, pay attention. This guy is essential viewing.
Wow. So that special was really the moment he went from being maybe a comedian's comedian, a scene linchpin,
to a globally recognized voice.
Yeah.
It was the ultimate validation for all those decades of work.
Okay, so we've talked about him on stage, on screen, but now let's shift to the work that often happens, you know, behind the curtain, his writing.
Right, which is just as important, if not more so sometimes.
Before that big special, and kind of alongside all his performing, he was doing some serious work as a writer off stage.
And this really confirms that his talent isn't just about performance. It's about the craft, the construction of comedy. And the biggest credit here, the really crucial one, he was a writer on Chappelle's Show.
Wow. Chappelle's Show. I mean, that show basically changed sketch comedy in the 2000s.
Yeah.
It was so sharp, so controversial, culturally essential.
Absolutely. Legendary. Yeah. Groundbreaking stuff.
So being in that writer's room, what does that tell us about Keith Robinson's skills that maybe his stand-up alone doesn't fully capture?
Well, it tells us he has a really advanced grasp of comedic structure. Stand-up, fundamentally, is about finding your personal truth, crafting a setup, a punchline, delivering it through your voice.
Right. It's very individual.
Very. Sketch writing, though, especially for a show like Chappelle's, that's a whole different beast.
Well, so.
It requires understanding character arcs, even short ones, narrative structure within a scene, and how to execute really complex, often super satirical ideas through other people's voices, through the actors.
He wasn't just writing for himself.
Exactly. He was helping craft material that Dave Chappelle and the cast would perform. Some of the most iconic, talked about sketches of the last, what, 20 plus years? He had a hand in that.
That's incredible. It really proves he doesn't just know how to be funny, but how to actually engineer funny for maximum impact.
Perfectly put. It shows that intellectual discipline behind the comedy reinforces why he was seen as such a valuable asset across the board.
And this ability to adapt, to work in different formats, it continues as the media landscape shifts again, right? Moving from TV sketch comedy into the podcast world.
Absolutely. You see that evolution continue. His next big move was into new media, co-hosting a podcast for a major platform, Spotify.
That was the show Amy Schumer Presents, Three Girls, One Keith. Debuted back in June 2018. And again, look who he's working with, Amy Schumer.
Another comedy powerhouse.
And her friends, Rachel Feinstein and Bridget Everett, also brilliant comedians.
Yeah, that collaboration is just another stamp of approval from the industry, isn't it? And it shows yet another dimension of his talent.
How is podcasting different from, say, stand-up or sketch writing for him?
Well, think about it. He's moving away from the high-pressure, tight structure of the stage or the intense focus of a writer's room.
Into something more relaxed.
More spontaneous, yeah. Long-form conversation. The topics are broader, too. They talk comedy, pop culture, politics, just their lives.
So his quick wit needs to work differently.
It has to translate into sustained back-and-forth insight. He's got to balance that, you know, sometimes aggressive back-of-the-bus edge with being collaborative, having a real dialogue with three other strong personalities.
So it really comes down to adaptability again.
Keyword, yeah.
He shows that the smarts fueling his stand-up work just as well in that intimate podcast setting. It lets his personality, maybe deeper thoughts, connect with listeners in a way that's different from a polished special.
Yeah, it's another example of him mastering a new way to communicate through comedy. Just keeps evolving.
Okay, and this is where the story takes a really significant turn. We move from professional achievements to something deeply personal, a major struggle, and ultimately, well, an incredible story of resilience.
Yeah, and this part is really powerful.
In 2016, Keith Robinson faced a health crisis, a life-altering event that honestly sounds like the absolute worst thing that could happen to a stand-up comedian.
That's right. In 2016, he suffered a stroke.
A stroke? I mean, for someone whose entire art form, whose whole career depends on what? Razor-sharp timing.
Precise verbal delivery.
Physical presence on stage.
The consequences were just devastating. The sources are clear about the immediate physical effects. The stroke left one side of his body partially paralyzed.
Oh, wow.
And it caused slurred speech. Think about that. For a comedian, that's like...
Like a singer losing their voice or a guitarist losing dexterity.
Exactly. It's the professional equivalent of losing your primary instrument.
So the logical next step should have been what? A long break, maybe even retirement.
That would be the expected path for sure. A mandatory long recovery period at the very least.
Yeah.
But That's not what happened.
What did the sources say?
They reveal something pretty profound, actually. Despite these huge physical challenges, the paralysis, the slurred speech, he kept performing stand-up.
Immediately, like right after.
It seems almost immediately, yeah. He continued.
That's hard to even fathom. The willpower involved.
It's immense. You can't overstate it. To get back on stage dealing with partial paralysis with a noticeable speech impediment, that's more than just dedication. It's an act of defiance.
It suggests comedy wasn't just his job anymore.
No, it clearly became something much deeper, like a crucial tool for his recovery. Therapeutic, almost. Both psychologically and physically.
How so? Physically?
Well, the stage basically became this place where he had to confront his condition publicly, every single night, in front of hundreds of people.
That must have fundamentally changed the dynamic with the audience, right?
Completely.
If the audience sees a comedian visibly struggling, doesn't that risk introducing pity? Which is kind of the opposite of what comedy aims for.
That's the potential danger, yeah.
Yeah.
Pity kills comedy. But this is where his mastery of his existing styles, his genres, really comes into play.
How did he handle it?
He leaned into it. Used his expertise in black comedy, in cringe humor, to address the elephant in the room straight away.
So he'd mentioned the slur, the physical stuff.
Right. By calling it out immediately, he uses the potential cringe of the situation not to get sympathy, but to actually force the audience to laugh at the awkwardness, at the discomfort.
Neutralizing it.
Exactly. He makes his physical limitations part of the shared joke, part of the absurd reality of the set. He turns what could be pity into shared, honest laughter.
Wow. Turning his recovery into, like, performance art, almost.
In a way, yeah. It's incredibly brave and incredibly skillful.
And this whole journey, performing while recovering, it didn't just stay confined to the club stages, right? He eventually took that incredibly personal, difficult experience.
And turned it into a major artistic statement. Yeah, his most recent comedy special.
Which directly tackles the whole thing.
Directly. That defining special came out in 2024 on Netflix. And the title, It's Perfect Dark Humor. Different Strokes.
Different Strokes. Yeah, that's clever. And bleakly funny.
Right. The wordplay nods right to the life-changing event. And the content of the special. He talks about the strokes, his recovery, at length. It's the core material for almost the whole hour.
So this feels like everything coming full circle, in a way.
How do you mean?
Well, he started his career using black comedy to talk about tough social realities in Philly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now he's using that exact same darkly funny analytical lens, but turning it inward on his own mortality, his own physical struggles.
That's a great way to put it. The vulnerability is just... Mm-hmm. Elevated.
Yeah.
Massively. He's still using his observational skills, but the focus is entirely internal now.
Observing his own recovery.
The absurdities of it, the frustrations, the indignities, the sheer difficulty. And using black comedy becomes this incredibly raw form of honesty, like therapeutic honesty.
It sounds like it would be tough to watch.
It is challenging, no doubt.
Yeah.
But because he's always been a comedian who operates right on that edge, that boundary of uncomfortable truth.
He can pull it off.
He manages to guide the audience through it. To get them to laugh with him, not at him, even about the darkest parts.
So the act of performing it, his actual delivery, becomes part of the message, too.
Absolutely. You're not just hearing jokes about having a stroke. You're watching a man actively, visibly, fighting through the effects of it, celebrating his survival, using stand-up as the medium.
That's incredibly powerful. It's a statement about art, perseverance.
All of the above. His whole career path, you know, the grit from Philly, the back of the bus honesty, the intellectual rigor from the Chappelle writing room, the relentless grind of the cellar.
It all kind of prepared him for this.
It feels like it did. He was already an expert at turning life's hard truths into humor. The stroke just gave him the hardest, most personal source material imaginable, his own fight to live, to get back to normal.
His career now, especially with Different Strokes, it feels like maybe one of the clearest examples out there of the actual healing power of comedy.
Transformative power, yeah. It's really something to behold. Hashtag tag outro.
So when we pull back and look at the whole picture, synthesizing this deep dive, Keith Robinson's career arc, it's really quite something.
It really is extraordinary.
We tracked him from, you know, that raw, determined voice coming out of Philly.
Back of the bus.
Back of the bus, funny, yeah? Becoming a national finalist on Star Search. evolving into this really respected writer for a show as huge as Chappelle's Show,
mm-hmm.
and being that crucial, reliable anchor, that linchpin at the Comedy Cellar.
And consistently earning the respect and collaboration of these major figures, right? Mm-hmm. Wanda Sykes, Colin Quinn, Kevin Hart, Amy Schumer.
Yeah, that says a lot.
It confirms he's seen as this incredibly talented peer.
Yeah.
Across all parts of the business. Writing, performing, podcasting.
But maybe the defining chapter is the one he's in right now, continuing his career, putting out that powerful Netflix special, Different Strokes.
All while actively recovering from and performing through the aftermath of a major stroke.
So for you listening, the relevance here, the takeaway.
Yeah.
It seems pretty clear. Keith Robinson's story is just a massive narrative of perseverance, especially in an industry like entertainment that can be so brutal.
Absolutely.
He really proves that genuine, hard-earned wit and just this deep, unwavering passion for the craft can help you overcome obstacles that seem completely insurmountable, physically, professionally.
It's a really compelling example of taking the absent toughest things life throws at you and actually shaping them into material. Material that doesn't just make people laugh, but connects deeply, validates, maybe even helps other people who are facing challenges they feel like they can't talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
And his journey, particularly this latest special, it leaves us with a really interesting question, I think, about the boundaries of humor.
Okay.
Well, given how incredibly vulnerable and, frankly, physically challenging his material in Different Strokes is, we have to ask, right? How does that line shift? The line between cringe humor, which usually makes us squirm because it's awkward or embarrassing, and therapeutic honesty, where the comedian is sharing something deeply personal for real connection. How does that boundary change when the joke itself is rooted so fundamentally in the comedian's own very real, very raw fight for recovery, for survival?
That's a fascinating question. It's not just about making us uncomfortable. It's about sharing profound struggle.
Exactly. It's this complex, powerful territory that Keith Robinson has navigated so skillfully. And maybe it's something worth thinking about next time you watch any comedy special that pushes those boundaries.
Where does our permission to laugh come from when the comedian's own vulnerability is right there, center stage?
Yeah, that intersection.
Yeah.
That's where the real art often lies, I think.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.